Oh my God, you're like listening to G'day World with Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network. Whatever.
G'day World, you're listening to Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network, recording this November 25th, 2008. Tonight I'm going to be playing an interview that I did a few weeks ago with a Brisbane chap called Wayne Denning. Wayne's the CEO of a company called Carbon Media. He's an Aboriginal man that I met a month or two ago via his business partner. And we got talking about the sort of situation with the Indigenous Australians circa 2008. And this is a subject that I've become, I guess, increasingly interested in over the last 4 or 5 years. And it's not a subject that I know a lot about. I certainly don't consider myself very well educated on the issue. But it was just, I guess the turning point for me was about 4 or 5 years ago. I sat down with a mate of mine in Melbourne, Andy Mullins. And Andy and his brother were shooting a documentary, I think, down in one of the Aboriginal settlements in South Australia. Andy's, a middle-class white boy, owns a bunch of pubs, very successful pubs in Melbourne these days, and building some in different parts of the country too. But, Andy really gave me a different perspective on the sort of the situation between the white Australians and the Aboriginal Australians. And he was sort of, it gave me this perspective about how most white people, and I include myself in this up to that point, really kind of just wash our hands of the situation of Aboriginal Australians. There seems to be this attitude, at least with the people that I know and mix with, and that, The Aboriginals get all of this money from the government and they have lots of opportunities to better themselves, access to education, access to welfare, access to training, access to this, that and the other. And if they don't want to take advantage of that, then there's nothing more that we can do. That's one of the common things that I hear when I get into discussions about this. And the other thing that I hear a lot is, well, look, you know, it wasn't my ancestors that came here in 1788 or in the early 18th century. It wasn't my ancestors that did this. You know, I'm not responsible for it. Situation is as it is, and we all just need to deal with it. And I kind of think that both of those sort of statements really don't appreciate the seriousness of the situation here. And one of the things that Andy Mullins said to me when he and I got talking about this 4 or 5 years ago was, you know, he said, you imagine if biologists or archaeologists discovered a civilization somewhere in Brazil or somewhere in Africa that was still around and that was 40,000 years old. He said they would be wrapping this civilization up with cotton wool and putting a bubble around it and not letting anyone touch with it, because it would be judged as being incredibly precious and something that should be really treated with a huge amount of care. And yet that's what we have in this country. The Indigenous Australians arrived here somewhere between 30, 40,000 years ago. I think they found remains dating about 40,000 years ago in South Australia. And yet, this people, this race of people, have had a really tough time over the last 220 years since the Europeans arrived in this country. And today, they're still having a very tough time for a whole variety of reasons. And yet, most white people who live in this country, I don't think, really give them much thought at all. So anyway, the reason for catching up with Wayne was really just to spend some time talking about these issues with somebody who obviously is much more familiar with the reality of the situation than I am, and to explore some of the things that we might do as a people with a way forward to this. So I'll jump straight into it. This is my interview with Wayne Denning. So how do you want me to introduce you, Wayne? CEO, Carbon Media? Is that your title? Is that what it says in your card? Managing Director?
Yeah, it's the title.
You'll have to speak up to anything too into this.
No, it's no problem.
So in terms of the Indigenous side of stuff, do you have any particular way you like to be described in terms of heritage, tribe?
No, just an Aboriginal man.
The something-something people?
Berry Gubba.
Berry Hubba?
Gubba.
Gubba, Berry Gubba. That's, is that from the Brisbane area?
No, it's from Whitsunday.
Whitsundays.
Yeah, central North Queensland.
So. Okay. And I guess it's one of the things that... okay, so let's go back. So the purpose for catching up and chatting is one of the things that I'm interested in developing myself is a better understanding of what's happening in Australia circa 2008 with A, the sort of the status of the Aboriginal communities around Australia, plus more importantly, the perception that the white slash European people in this country have of what's going on. How much of that is accurate, how much of that is inaccurate and is based on media bias or government agendas or whatever's going on?
Yeah, sure.
So one of the things that I've heard is that when talking about the Indigenous communities in Australia, it's difficult to group them all up into one because it's difficult to get...
No, there's no homogenous group as such, although I think Western settlement likes to think of it that way. I mean, obviously, we're over 300 individual nations and language groups as diverse as Europe, if not, well, significantly more diverse, more languages, more groups than, say, in Europe, but people have no problem understanding that.
Yep.
In Australia, there's no one homogeneous Indigenous or Aboriginal group. I mean, there's quite clearly two distinct groups in the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander groups, and then within those groups there are obviously groups of islands and also nation groups within that as well. So yeah, it's not a great leap of faith. It's just that they happen to be the, you know, it's not one homogenous group.
And so does that lead to when we're discussing the you know, the problem, the issues facing the Aboriginal communities, is it difficult to generalise or to come up with consensus among the communities about, you know, what the issues are or what they want? Is there a lot of dialogue amongst the nations?
I mean, there is common issues that confront all Indigenous groups, Aboriginal groups. I mean, collectively, yes, there is a collective, and mainly because there is collective in dealing with it. Federal government, Australia generally, and in individual states. So, I mean, people often, there's a common experience that's shared across the nation between Indigenous groups. The same impact, just different timescales, I think, and how time's moved on. So, you know, you obviously got groups that have been able to maintain or to a varying extent their culture and language, as opposed to the impacts on culture and language in more developed parts of the country, which have been exposed to European settlement for a longer period, for the last couple hundred years. So those impacts have, they've had varying successes. And I mean, we've got development occurring at that time too, the 21st century and so forth. Those things have their, they have their impact on time. So, but having said that, there's also resurgences in language. The reteaching of languages in places where people probably think Indigenous culture has been significantly impacted, in places like Tasmania, where you have schools teaching Aboriginal languages and revitalising it. And then to areas of the country where the languages are under a significant threat. You know, it's the other way around. Those languages where people have been able to continuously speak and express their culture are considered the greatest numbers at threat, obviously, because 21st century life is quite imposing. Globalisation has its impact.
Right. So tell us a bit about your story. I mean, where you were brought up in Brisbane, or were you brought up somewhere else in Queensland?
No, I was brought up in small mining town out of Rockhampton called Blackwater.
Yep.
My family, my Aboriginal side is from a small Aboriginal community called Warrabinda in the main. They'll move there over time, like most the Indigenous experiences are in Queensland, where Aboriginal groups will move from their traditional lands to reservations or missions, discrete communities as they're called now. There's about 32 odd in this state. Warrabinda is one of them. Sherberg's another, which is just 3 hours north of Brisbane. Warrabinda's out of Rockhampton. And then we go up to the ones further north, like Palm Island and Doomadgee, and right up to the Torres Straits, you know. So they have varying impacts, but Indigenous groups have been moved there, and traditional groups from different parts have moved to other parts of the state to totally confuse situations and make it all complicated. So that's part of my experience. Traditionally, our country comes, I mean, I've got linkages through from the Whitsundays area, the Berrigubba area regions, and also up into Cape York as well. So,
and did you grow up in a predominantly Aboriginal community?
Well, no, I grew up in a mining town, but my experience was predominantly Indigenous because my father is actually English. My mother's Aboriginal. He worked on the railways. Most of the people we worked with and lived with were Aboriginal families and cousins of mine, so we had very much an Indigenous experience, really. It's just the way it was.
Mm. And you went through the typical sort of state school
system? Yeah, I just went through the Blackwater primary school and then to the high school, those sorts of things. Became a school captain, those sorts of things.
Yeah.
Went to a regional university in Rockhampton for a while, got a job in Canberra. Became a policy officer down there. Spent 8 years there.
In Indigenous affairs or something
yeah,
else?
Yeah, I was in the land rights area.
Okay.
Rights agenda programs.
During which sort of period?
The 1992 through to all...
Keating?
Yeah.
Okay.
Keating periods.
Yep.
Saw the change of government in 96.
Right. So sort of kind of the end of the whole Mabo...
Well, right at the peak of it, originally. Mabo came in 93. It was one of the reasons I went to Canberra.
Right.
I had also regional experiences at that time up in Cairns and elsewhere where the debate was running strong.
Yep.
And the Mabo decision was in 1993. I worked in that area, so... watched a lot of changes, watched a couple of High Court decisions,
yep.
challenges from the states, the WA government's challenge of the original Native Title Act and its validity under the court government of the time, and then subsequently the WIC amendments, which were related to the existence of Native Title over what was, you know, over pastoral leases and the subsequent responses to that, which ultimately came out through a different Prime Minister in terms of the Howard years. They sort of looked at it in quite a different framework to what Paul Keating did. And so, yeah, subsequently, it was part of all that right up until about 2004.
Okay.
And I left the public service in that area to proceed in a sort of different vein in the media.
Yep. You know, one of the things I wanted to sort of get your perspective on is when I get drawn into conversations, obviously with the white folk about the issues today, I get a handful of responses pretty much every time, and you know the most common one is almost shrugging of the shoulders. You know, whenever we start talking about well. The perception that we get out of the media is that there is still a lot of there's a lot of issues in Indigenous communities around Australia. You know, we always hear about the big ones. You know, the alcoholism, child molestation. This is the stuff that the press loves to wave the flag about. But outside of that, it's more an issue of integration or not integration, just access to education, to you know, all of these sorts of things. The most common initial response when I start this conversation with other white Australians is they shrug their shoulders and go, well, you know, they get all this money, they piss it up against the wall. You know, you hear stories of, oh, they buy Land Rovers and then just, you know, drive them once when they run out of petrol, they leave them by the side of the road. You hear this stuff over and over again, and it's almost like there's nothing more that we can do, or we've done everything that we can do, and, you know, it's almost like a, I don't know, it's not our problem kind of thing. I started to become a lot more interested in the issue a few years ago when I met a guy, a white guy, a young guy, who had spent a lot of time in some Indigenous communities in South Australia. And, you know, the perspective he gave to me, which sort of shocked me, he said, you know, this is at least a 40,000-year-old civilization that's in our backyard, and we're just letting it, you know, drift off into non-existence. We're not sort of treating it with the awe and respect that we should for a 40,000-year-old culture. I mean, it's mind-boggling. And if we found a 40,000-year-old civilization in the middle of the Amazon jungle, you know, scientists would be building a bubble around it and treating it like it was to be respected, yet we have one in this country and we kind of ignore it. I mean, what's your perspective on the current issues? Let's start there. Is there an issue and are there many issues?
Well, I mean, there are many issues. The issues are real.
What are the key issues from your perspective?
Well, the key issues, I mean, and you hear it from the government right across the board, the key issue is health, life expectancy. These are hardcore issues. People are dying. Dying on average 20, 25 years earlier than the average Australian in Indigenous communities. And this is right across the board, even in urban areas. There's a sense of economic disparity. Opportunities and access to work is difficult. And these things obviously have their impact. So, I mean, it's probably proven that with economic opportunities, you increase aspects to livelihood and health and other access to services. So those are a direct impact on Indigenous people. There are still issues associated with, in a broad context, the realisation in Australia that, you know, it does have an Indigenous history. Australia has a history that is over 40,000 years old, and I think there is still a level of reconciliation within people, the mindset of the country as a nation, to appreciate that. I think it is Australia's unique selling point to the world that it does have a unique Indigenous culture, along with its natural beauty. Australia needs to embrace that more. There's a lot to be gained by that. But these issues, in terms of the issues are real, you know, and they're hardcore, hard-hitting issues. Average educational issues, you know, average completion of schooling is low. Child mortality rates are high. Life expectancies, on average, is 20 years less. And this is unheard of. These are third-world conditions and, you know, the disadvantage on all social indicators is significant. Indigenous people in this country occupy the lower rung on every possible indicator, and that's got to be an embarrassment for this country.
Let's talk about the sort of education / opportunity access angle. Aren't you the poster child, though, for the people who say, well, you know, they have equal opportunity to get involved in education career-wise. In fact, they probably have unequal opportunity to their advantage because there's legislation in place that gives them, you know, better access to education and more opportunities. And here you are, you're, you know, managing director of a media company in Brisbane, doing very well. Aren't you evidence that the opportunities are there if people want to take them? Or is there something else in the story that explains the fact that you're doing well?
Oh, look, I think it's more to do with the generational movement of opportunity, probably for want of a better concept. It's like on the main, the average Indigenous group or population is at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. That's not to say there aren't individuals that are having opportunities to achieve beyond that, as it is in any group in society. You know, but as a group, as a collective, these things aren't evident across the board. You know, it's the fact that as a society, Indigenous groups are occupying, on every low socioeconomic indicator, the bottom rung of society. And this has been, part of the problem is that this has been a major focus for government programs in terms of, I suppose the focus has just been on keeping pace with the rest of society and the development of society, and so focusing on the keeping pace element rather than the promotion of excellence and opportunity. I mean, people break through in every society on this planet, and Indigenous communities aren't any different. To the extent that I consider myself host of pin-up for the whole setup, well, I don't really. I mean, I think it's a case of just going out there and showing, showing a bit of initiative. I mean, I embrace things myself, you know. I just, I've made opportunities where there haven't been opportunities. I utilise Indigenous elements as a unique selling point. I think this is something to be proud of, and I think if we're clever enough as a society, this can work across the board.
So I guess the question I have is are the opportunities there, but something in the psychology or the culture of the vast majority of people in the Indigenous communities prevents them from taking advantage of those opportunities? Or were you exceptional in your ability to just break through the barriers and, or were you lucky, or is there something unique or special about you and people like you that have managed to break through? Or is there something generically that prevents vast majority of members of these communities to actually do what you've done?
I mean, it's a difficult question to answer. I mean, I don't know if I'm unique. I've had opportunity. I've studied and worked hard. There's no secrecy in the model. It's just a hard working model. And taking advantage of that. In terms of why other people haven't, well, I mean, again, I think it's because, you know, there's a lot of people living where there is a sense of hopelessness. I've had to give up a lot. I mean, I've had to move to where the work is, you know. I've had to leave home. I've had to, travel.
But that's the same with white people too, right? Yeah. I mean, I grew up in Bundaberg, which was I think it had the highest unemployment per capita when I left there in 1988. I moved to Melbourne to go where the opportunities were, right? That's not a unique problem to Indigenous communities. Although I suspect that some of these, the hopelessness in some of the Indigenous communities is probably stronger than it is even in places like Bundaberg.
Yeah, I mean, the other disparity is a connection to traditional connection to country, to identity and how that impacts, you know, and movement away from that to families. Changes, I mean, the impact of economic shifts across the board, from the pastoral industry in this country to probably one more focus on mining and those sorts of things, and the fact that, to the great extent, Indigenous people haven't had the opportunity, even though you've got these mining developments on their countries, it's, for whatever reason, being able to crack into that appropriately with the right level of skills, etc., it's not been that easy. I don't know why that is. It just hasn't translated to the extent it should in terms of employment. I mean, these type of things are, I'm just as much baffled by a lot of it as anyone else. And all I know is that, I mean, one of the solutions for me is, I mean, I heard a guy who was a Native American, was out for a conference once a couple of years ago,
And he talked about the idea of welfare being one of the worst things that was ever introduced. And I suppose opportunity and the need to seek opportunity is embraced by not having an alternative.
So. Yeah. I mean, and I think that's true, again, with white people. I think, you know, I grew up in a place where there was a lot of welfare, and I've seen successive generational welfare, and each generation whose parents grew up on welfare, it gets
worse.
Harder and harder to break out of that kind of cycle, right?
Yeah, and you've had this, for whatever reason, with government policies, institutional approaches to Indigenous communities, and over generations in Australia, over the last 100 years or so, these have had their impacts. You know, leadership has been affected in terms of community.
Yeah.
Role models being impacted upon, parenting skills being diminished, traditional law and custom has been impacted on. You're caught in this limbo between Western culture and civilization and traditional Indigenous culture and approaches because of, rightly or wrongly, systematic approaches by various government, states, institutions, churches, religious groups, whatever, departments of education that probably inadvertently, certainly not, I didn't think, I mean, although it's debatable, deliberately, have caused a problem.
Yeah.
I mean, and some people have been able to transcend and work through that, but collectively, I think there's been a major impact. But having said that, there is an ever-increasing Indigenous middle class starting to appear.
Really?
Which, for the first time, would indicate some successes. I mean, I don't know if it's, you could sort of say it's because of the programs and policies of government. I mean, to me, I think you need to diminish the role of governments in the day-to-day lives of everyday people. I think the more involved government and their policies and programs are, the more problems it causes, just by the nature of those programs and policies. But arguably, you know, government's got a responsibility to, you know, for some reasons, as you know, the reasons I've outlined before, that the impacts of institutions and previous policies have been significant in terms of leadership and societal capabilities for Indigenous groups. These manifest themselves in social dysfunction and economic loss that people have today that you point out. And I mean, the fact that people suspect, you know, people are incapable, which is not true, or that you know, there is some sort of lack of capability or, you know, skill in Indigenous communities. It's just more of just a manifestation or an easy cop-out.
And to me, my big concern is that this is a form of insidious, inherent racism in Australians, where it's not an oppressive form of racism, where people aren't going out deliberately trying to attack Indigenous people. It's almost like a just turning a blind eye form of racism. Like, let's just pretend it's there's nothing we can do. Let's just wash our hands of it, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that in the past 11 years under various different governments, I mean, I think there's a bit of history in this too. I think the Keating era that I, you know, I had an opportunity to work in the federal government with, you saw a very much a strong focus on minority groups in this country. You know, that sort of socialism that was, you know, trying to prop up an engagement, a different policy framework map across the board. This of course, was changed, and the approaches with the standardisationist One Australia model that was developed by the Howard government, which probably looked to force groups into a particular framework.
And you think it's changing under Rudd?
Well, I mean, at the beginning of the year, there was an apology. Howard failed to deliver on that to the Indigenous groups. I mean,
Was that just easy political point scoring, though, or was it? Do you think it represents a genuine shift in policy?
I mean, it's yet to be seen. I think it had to be said. I just think, for the purposes of just moving forward, I don't know, line in the sand stuff. Symbols do have significance,
and certainly it seemed to me anyway that the majority of Australians wanted it to happen. It was
we've seen these momentums before, you know, with the bridge walks and stuff previously, the referendum in 1967 for Indigenous people to be considered Australian citizens, these type of things. I mean, that's stretch out ridiculous. This is.
Where were you born?
Me, 1970.
Yeah. Me too, right? Yeah. So we were both born 3 years after. I mean, that is just...
outrageous.
It is outrageous. It is mind-boggling to think that up until 1967, Indigenous people in this country weren't considered Australian citizens. I mean, it's
could die in wars, could pay taxes.
It's mind-boggling, right?
But
mind-boggling.
Yeah.
And, you know, I guess the thing that, I think is very hard for a lot of people to appreciate is... the recognition that the European experience over the last 1,000 years is one of uninterrupted progress, slow, methodical progress from, you know, through the Middle Ages into the Industrial Revolution, etc. And, you know, our systems and our legal systems, our social systems have gradually evolved over time, but they've been pretty consistent. Whereas when you take any of the Indigenous peoples around the world, not just Aboriginal Australian, but, you know, the Native Americans or the Native South Americans, you have a period of time, and in this case, 40,000 years of, you know, social customs and laws that had been developed, and then all of a sudden, you know, snap broken for a period of, you know, the best part of a couple of centuries. Mm. And all of a sudden in the last 40, 50 years, we've tried to sort of pick everyone back up, put them on their feet and say, all right, off you go, assimilate, live like, live well. You know, when there's been that major disruption to a way of life, and you mentioned leadership a couple of times, and I can imagine that it must have been very emotionally tumultuous for the leaders of those communities during that, you know, a couple of hundred years to know that this land that their forefathers had lived on uninterrupted for, you know, 40,000 years, which is mind-boggling in itself. I think that the great pyramids of Cheops were only 4,000 years ago. We're talking about 40,000 years. And then all of a sudden that they lost that in one fell swoop and, you know, were treated like animals for a large part of the time. I mean, it must be impossible for any sense of self-esteem is not the right word, but self... self-worth. I'm thinking about, you know, when a community just completely gets invaded, overrun, all of its customs and ways just shattered, it must have been very damaging, I imagine. It's hard to pick up after that. You know, the analogy that I often use with people, it's like, you know, me walking into your house with a couple of mates with AK-47s, you know, raping your wife, killing your kids, beating you around the head, tying you up in chains, putting you in the corner, staying there for 10 years, eating your food, living in your house, and then one day getting up and leaving and untying you and say, all right, off you go. You know, sorry about that. Here's some money. Pick yourself back up. You'll be right, mate.
Mm.
You know, it just doesn't work that way, right?
Very graphic.
Well, it is, but I think...
sort of makes the point.
Well, yeah. What happened was very graphic, right? The Christians came here and... yeah, that's. Let me ask you this question. I mean, do you think that the way kids are taught this history now in the education system in this state, let's say, is an accurate representation of what happened, or has it still been whitewashed?
Look, I think there's been a vast movement. I think... I don't know if it's to the extent it should be. I think that but it's certainly a lot more than it was when I was in primary school and all the rest of it.
Under Joe.
Yeah. the focus was clearly about, European history and settlement of Australia without an Indigenous. It only started 200 years ago, which was ridiculous anyway. But, I mean, there certainly is a lot stronger focus on that, which, I think...
Yeah, we still celebrate Australia Day.
Yeah, I mean, I think Australia's a bit... We've got a few of its own issues to sort out as a nation in terms of a true identity, you know. You can see that with our flag, with the head of state and those sorts of things. I mean, not that I'm promoting one thing or another, but there is a bit of a confusion there that I'm sure any immigrant to Australia would be somewhat confused about. The system works, but it's... I'm not saying it's not confusing.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's across the board. So, I mean, at some point Australia's going to grow up, embrace its past, its true past, and embrace the reality of the current circumstance and progressively together make a future that is truly remarkable, I'd imagine, if it does those things properly.
You said earlier on, and I know when we caught up for lunch a couple of weeks ago, you said this, that you think that embracing the Aboriginal culture in Australia and the length of that heritage should be a big selling point. Obviously, Aboriginal art has been a rising thing for the last 20 years, but...
Yeah, well, even how that's defined is quite problematic, I've heard it said, the definition of Indigenous art is... defined by the dealers who are traditionally non-Indigenous, and certain Indigenous groups, the type of work they do is not actually defined as Aboriginal art, which makes quite confusing. Australia, but to take your point, Australia does in fact have a couple. I may refer to this slightly earlier. It's just like we do have some unique aspects in this country, and I think embracing Indigenous culture and knowledge and science and systems in an embracing way rather than in a sort of stealth way in a way in which Australia is embarrassed about, could achieve a lot. I think there's a level of guilt that still exists on how this country was settled, and I think that probably impacted on a couple of generations ago, but what that's effectively created is a barrier between social acceptance and responsibility across the board in this country, saying that's not our problem, that was the doings of our forefathers. It's easy to do that when you live in an internet generation where you can watch events and accidents on television and be totally disconnected from it unless you're personally involved. It's not just the Indigenous issues that are subject to that sort of removed lack of passion or connectedness to it. So
that whole "it was our forefathers" excuse kind of annoys me as well. I mean, using my house invasion analogy, I always say it's like, okay, well, your father invaded the house and then gave it to you. Mm. Do you have a right to live in that house? The legal system would say no, but when it comes to this issue, people say, well, that's okay.
Yeah, the problem comes down to the legal system at the end of the day. But
and yet the Jews that were terrorised by the Nazis in World War II got all of their wealth back, and they got a country, goddammit, for themselves, carved out of Palestine. Mm. That was only 50 years ago. But for some reason, something that happened 200 years ago is considered, well, it's too late to do anything about it now. Right?
Well, and the reality is that didn't happen 200 years ago. That happened in successive movements across as much as recently.
Over 200 years. Yeah.
It wasn't one big swell,
Yeah. So obviously you're in the media business, I'm in the media business, and I think we both believe that media is a good place to start to change the way that people think about these issues. I was with some people down in Hunter Valley over the last couple of days at a media industry event, and interestingly, we had a lot of discussions about this topic, and somebody brought up the subject that if you look on Australian television for Indigenous people, we were trying to work out how many that we knew of, and specifically said Ernie Dingo, Stan Grant, and I think there's one or two other news readers on SBS whose names I don't know, but that was about, apart from, you know, specific programming on SBS, talking about general audience viewing, and with a population of 23 million people, and how many Indigenous people now? 750,000?
Yeah, I think. Well, maybe that's a bit generous, but yeah, about somewhere between 500 and 750.
So let's say 1 in 25 people in this country is of Indigenous background, and certainly not 1 in 25 people on our television screens. So do you think that would help? I know that in New Zealand, I've heard it's very different. The Maori headcount is...
1 in 3, though. So
right, yeah, okay.
Population must be... But I think just being out there in mainstream, I think a lot of people aren't chest beaters even about their identity.
Sure.
I think they just go about life.
Yep.
And are hardworking and are who they are.
Yeah, yeah.
And aren't necessarily there to be role models.
Or activists.
And, yeah, it's just a case of getting on with life. So
yeah.
And that's to be appreciated and respected for its own worth.
Sure.
Others, on the other hand, Anthony Mundines of the world, are very vocal and proud, and that's to be respected too. I mean, they have points to be made, and a level of it driven by frustration. And I suppose we can all appreciate that, you know, we want things to happen and change to happen quicker, you know, but democratise media. I think opportunities to have a voice and the way people are seen and heard has changed anyway. So necessarily being on, you know, you talk about 1 in 25 people Indigenous on the main networks in this country, it's a question about whether those main networks are relevant in the future anyway.
Yeah.
They are very much a controlled avenue. Again, those sorts of things that we look at in the true context. I think people are actually actively embracing new ways of presenting themselves and their issues. I just think those sorts of things are to be respected as well. So it's not quite as apparent, I suppose, as you'd like. But having said that, I think Australia needs more role models that are Indigenous as well. And we've got a new Governor General who's very pro with her Indigenous support.
The new federal Governor General, the Australian Governor General?
Yeah,
really?
Quinton
Bryce, yeah.
Yeah, she's very vocal about Indigenous matters as well, as had been previous ones. So that's good. We've got a new government in terms of a Prime Minister that's vocal. We've got at least symbols of respect that haven't been there in the past, like acknowledgements of traditional owners by senior government officials, even premiers of states that had previously wouldn't have even contemplated that. We've got a movement across the board that is probably becoming a little bit more embracing, at least on a symbolic level. The true meaning of that, I don't know, but at least it's a start. Certainly better than where we were. But, you know, certainly a lot more's got to be done. And the more Indigenous people that we have as doctors, I suppose journalists and heads of industry and all the rest of it, the more we'll crack open this whole situation, you know.
I know you, as part of your work, you travel around to a lot of Indigenous communities. In terms of the healthcare issues that you mentioned earlier on, I mean, what's the key problem with life expectancy and healthcare? Is it that these services aren't available in these communities, or is it some other issue?
Oh, look, it's a mixture of things. You know, services are part of it. You know, a lot of Indigenous communities live in very remote parts of the country. I mean, health is an issue for everyone.
Yeah.
I mean, I think they just manifest themselves in Indigenous communities to the extreme. Nutrition's difficult. Quality of produce, diabetes, lifestyle.
Is obesity as big a problem as it is in, you know, the rest of the country?
Can be, because the quality of produce, that's, I mean, cheaper cuts of meat are made available. People probably, I mean, I certainly know, can't explicitly say about obesity, but diabetes is certainly massive. It's a major problem in Indigenous communities, and that's generally related to nutrition. Obesity is big.
You know, when I think Indigenous community, the images that flash into my mind are the ones that I would see on the Current Affair or the 6 o'clock news. Right, I imagine a place that's in the middle of nowhere. It's dry. It's got a few shacks in it. These dirt roads, kids walking around with some sort of a dingo or a dog walking at their feet, very desolate looking sort of ghost town sort of style. Is that just the images the media likes to pull out, or is that an accurate reflection of a lot of these communities in Queensland and the Northern Territory, Western Australia?
Look, it depends on the environment. I mean, you've got communities that are every bit as stereotypical, I guess. I mean,
well, we don't see those ones on the news.
No, but you don't see those sorts of things on Current Affair, do you? I mean, is everyone going to get their door bust down with a camera guy and a foot in the door? It's just the reality is, I mean, look, communities are in difficult remote areas. It's costly to build houses, it's costly to get access to resources and support these things. It's just Australia's a big country, and it costs a lot of money.
So they either get driven into the metro areas, they get driven into the areas where the healthcare is available, or we have to figure out, how hard is it to build healthcare systems in these places, to build hospitals and get doctors into them?
Very difficult.
Why is it difficult?
I mean, it's a question plaguing right across the board. You know, it's just supply and demand. It's the economics of the health systems. It's also about preventable diseases. It ties to healthy lifestyle and living.
But it's not. I mean, this is Australia. It's not like we're talking about the Congo or Kenya here. I mean, we're talking about a country that's at least been aware of this issue and talking about doing something about it as long as I've been around, for nearly 40 years. How hard is it to build some hospitals, train some doctors and medical staff, and get them into these centres around Australia? It doesn't seem to me like a big problem, right? Or a difficult problem over 40 years to build hospitals in these communities and staff them.
Yeah, I don't have the answer, but apparently it is.
And there's a billion people wanting to immigrate to Australia. We go, okay, well, if you're a doctor or a nurse, get yourself out there, do 5 years.
But like I said, these health service issues aren't just necessarily plaguing Indigenous communities, they're plaguing every community. And people are suffering in that regard right across the board.
But you started off the conversation saying that life expectancy is a lot lower in Indigenous communities, so obviously it's plaguing them worse, right?
Well, it does, yeah. I mean, it just does. People have to travel further. If you don't have money to travel, if you don't have access to the doctors, if you're reliant totally on the public health system, you don't have access to appropriate nutrition or health services, to preventable health services, you're going to suffer.
One of the guys I was with in Hunter Valley is a friend of mine, formerly the a senior, very senior journalist for the Financial Review in Australia, and long career in journalism. And he's now studying to be a pastor. And he was telling me that his church, which is one of these evangelical kind of church things, has a program where they go out and they spend time in Indigenous communities. And according to him, they're not proselytizing, they just want to go and understand before they try and help. And he was talking about how he and his wife are about to go out and spend a week or a couple of weeks in the community. Is that something you think is a good thing for more white people to do, to go spend time in these communities, or is it somehow tacky for people to go out and want to spend time in these communities?
I don't know. I don't know what the situation is there. I mean, I think people want assistance with services, services that will create opportunities. And if people honestly think that's what they can bring to those communities, and these communities can be here in Brisbane. I mean, we have Indigenous communities very close to some of our urban capitals and centres. If they bring something of worth to those communities, and go all the more. But the same time of understanding there are some pretty key issues. I mean, it's blatantly obvious some of the issues that will be, you know, that will need to be addressed, and these issues take generational change. People need jobs, they need improved services, they need better housing, they need access to infrastructure that will link them appropriately to the outside world. And these things, as much as we think and take them for granted in the cities, aren't that accessible across the board. They're just not there, despite what people say. You know? And the dependency on government as a service provider is immense. And until such a point where we're able to clearly adjust the focus on that, and that Indigenous people have embraced and able to project their own aspirations and achievements independently of government, then we're always going to be caught in this sort of catch-22. So.
Yeah, look, I'm a big believer in many aspects of social change, that it's not enough for anyone to sit around and wait for the government to do it.
Yeah. I mean, like, I seriously think, I think some of the initiatives that I'm hearing now with the hearing talks of minority councils where you get Indigenous groups or entrepreneurs linking up with, through a select service council, with big business, I think, and offering services on that level in a managed and managed equal way. I think those sorts of things, they seem to work, I'm hearing talk of those sorts of things working quite well in the United States and Canada and the United Kingdom. They're new ways of doing business. They're directly focusing resources and funds where they're required.
Mm-hmm.
And they're working with the entrepreneurial model. I think those sorts of things need to be facilitated. I know the government in this country is really focused on land ownership and home ownership for Indigenous communities as a wealth generation point. More people owning their own homes seem to be an indicator on improving economic opportunities. Therefore, improving economic opportunities seems to translate into improved health, all those sorts of things improve. I think things, it's going to take time, but we don't have a lot of time, you know. And I suppose, from my perspective, the more people appreciate that, or get an understanding of that, the better, and then realise that we all have a responsibility across the board. I mean, whilst we've got a group in this country of Australians that aren't able to be fully embraced in the wealth of this country and how it translates into to day-to-day life and even the survival of your children, we've failed as a country.
And we, you know, we run around and criticise China for its human rights record and lots of other countries when we've got this happening in our own country and most people just turn a blind eye to it.
I think people can deal with China because it's not here.
Yeah, it's not us, right? Yeah, it's easy to criticise others, but we've got... This is obviously a really, really and tragically serious issue.
And there's no easy fix, and a lot of people having a go at it. I mean, and have been for quite a while, but there's no easy fix. And I don't envy the task of those that are, you know, focused on it. As, you know, it's monumental, I think. I think we all have something to offer over time, you know.
Thanks, mate.
And don't forget, folks, we rely on your support here at TPN. We're still running the TPN pledge drive. And, you know, really to keep TPN running, we need your support to pay for the servers and the bandwidth and all the different expenses, the IT costs for keeping it going. This is the indie media. It's not the big corporate media. And anything you can do to support us in the pledge drive will be really appreciated. Will help us stay on the air and keep producing podcasts like the interview tonight with Wayne. The URL for the pledge drive is tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com/pledge. And thanks very much sincerely to everyone who's already contributed and supported us. You guys rock. This is Cameron out.